Welcome to Open Book. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Henry Warrenitz, who is the star of An Iliad, now playing at Berkeley Rep through November 18th. An Iliad is a co-production with La Jolla Playhouse and was written by Lisa Peterson and Dennis O'Hare and directed by Lisa Peterson. Henry Warrenitz, how did you get involved in working on this one-man show?
Well, I got a call sometime in early spring. I think it was maybe February, March of this past year. And I was teaching at the time. I was the head of the MFA program at Illinois State University, the acting program there. And I'd been relatively new to the teaching process. I'd been a regional theater actor and director for many years. And Tony Taccone, who's the artistic director at Berkeley Rep, I had been in touch with Tony that I was going to be leaving my teaching position and getting out back into the profession. And I think that had something to do with it a little bit, but I got a call from a casting agency in New York that I had some work done with, and they asked if I would be interested in doing this project, and if I was available and could I audition. And Lisa and I were in different places, so we couldn't get together, but I sent out a little videotape in, and I got cast that way. And I subsequently, you know, talking to Tony Taccone here, the rep, saying, you know, how much he said, well, your name was in there, so, you know, it was a very good opportunity for me to get back into the profession as I was spending some time teaching.
The show itself started in New York with Dennis O'Hare, and I think there was another actor alternating the role.
Yeah, it actually goes further back than that. I think Dennis and Lisa started working on the play, on the piece, sometime in, I think, 2003. I think Lisa talks about it as a reaction to the invasion of Iraq, the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and that war going on there. And they started working on the Iliad and telling the story to each other, and they spent many months kind of distilling it down using the Robert Fagel's contemporary translation, but also as the play comes together, the character of the poet who I play also speaks in his own voice, but speaks in a storyteller's voice, and then speaks in the Fagel's voice, so there's a lot of layers to it. My understanding is that Dennis and Lisa did kind of a reading of it at the Sundance Playwright Festival that goes on in Utah. I think that's where Tony first kind of came across it in terms of the rep. But then I think the first actual production was up in Seattle about maybe 3-4 years ago at the Seattle Rep. And then there was a subsequent production at the MacArthur Theater in Princeton, New Jersey, with Steven Spinella, who is the Tony Award-winning actor from Angels in America. And finally, Dennis O'Hare, the co-author, finally got a chance to do it himself as well, just this past spring at New York Theater Workshop in the city. And Steven Spinella also, they traded the role off, you know, alternate nights, because as you've seen the play, it's a long, exhausting evening for one actor. So that's how it came about in terms of that.
At what point in that did you get involved? Was that while it was in New York then? Or?
It was still playing in New York when the co-production between La Jolla Playhouse and Berkeley Rep was, I think, being put together.
Henry Warrenitz, had you done any one-man shows before?
I never had, and I'd been, really? You know, it's funny, I'd been interested in doing it for a while. I've been a professional actor or director and producer for, you know, over 35 years, and I have never done a one-man show. It's one of the things I haven't done, and I've been thinking about that in the past several years. I mean, you get to a certain point in your career, you're looking for different challenges and things to kind of really kind of energize you, and that, boy, that would be very different, something to do. And so I've been thinking about it, ironically, in the past year or so, and then this opportunity came up that was, you know, kind of right up my alley. I've done a lot of Shakespeare work. I've done a lot of classical big language plays, and this story kind of encompasses a lot of that, but it's a lot of direct address narrative storytelling to an audience from one character, which I really enjoy on stage as well. So it was a nice mixture of historical drama and kind of energetic storytelling and a great script and a lot of, you know, playing to the Berkeley audience has been terrific because they're very, very knowledgeable about the material, and they come up with a lot of opinions and responses to what the story tells us.
When you're trying to memorize it, breaking it down into different characters and different kinds of declamations probably makes it a bit easier to remember it all.
In some ways, I mean, you do have these scenes that go on within the play. There's somewhere around 14 or 15 characters in the play, counting Achilles' horse, you know, who has one little line. But that certainly makes it easier to rehearse. Lisa and Dennis, they've kind of broken the script down into seven sections. You know, one's about the war, one's about Patroclus, one's about kind of the opening introduction of the piece, and then there's the last sweep of the play, which is Achilles and Priam burying the body of Hector. And so there's a storytelling arc to it, which is helpful. But you're right, I mean, working with those various characters where you get little scenes that, even though you're playing it with yourself, you have a dynamic and an action within the scene to hold on to, so it's not just pure storytelling, linear storytelling. So you do get some nice scene work going on.
When you're creating the overall character of the storyteller, what kind of physical life are you looking for there?
Well, I'm very interested in language, and I always have been. I think that's my background in Shakespeare. So I a lot of my clues for how the character thinks or works or moves comes from what he says as I work on a character. There's a certain frenetic, almost improvisational quality to a lot of the poet's kind of off-script banter with the audience. I mean, Lisa's and Dennis's concept is this is, you know, they think of him as Homer in some ways, that he's been traveling through time telling this story again and again, and he keeps hoping that he's going to be able to finish it one night and be done with it. And so there's a frenetic kind of need to tell the story. There's also a forgetfulness about this guy. He can't remember certain things. And he's somewhat, as you've seen the production, he's somewhat disheveled in his costume. He looks like he could be one of these guys sitting out on the street here down on Shattuck Avenue. When I walk back to our company housing apartments here every evening after the show, I walk by many of these poets as I walk down the street. Some of them are quite interesting characters, and I see myself once in a while there, which is funny. But that, you know, the language is what, you know, generally for myself at least as an actor, I really hold on to, and I get interested in why a character puts things a certain way. And there's real, as we just mentioned, there's multiple layers of language in this play. There's the Fagel's translation, which is very poetical and heightened verse, and then there's kind of just storytelling narrative that the poet also talks about that keeps the story moving. And then he steps out of that and has this kind of very colloquial, almost improvisational commentary about what he's doing or what the story's doing, or it was something about the audience trying to get them to talk to them directly one-on-one. And a lot of that stuff, as you listen to the play, it sounds very made up on the spot, but it's all written down. I mean, Lisa and Dennis told each other these sections of the story, and they recorded it, and then they had it transposed into a script, so, you know, they get to work that way, which was fun.
The Iliad itself, using the Iliad as an anti-war statement, how common is that? Did you do any research on the history of the Iliad and how it's told?
I've read it, and I've been reading some of the commentaries of it, and it's, I mean, Lisa will say this just herself, it's actually not an anti-war
Yeah,
poem. It's a pro-war poem. It's about all these things that war does. Now, at the same time, I think there is a subliminal message in there that's about, yeah, this is what war does, but there's also the other side of what war does that we don't talk about. And by leaving some of that out, I think Dennis and Lisa, in their contributions to the piece, the commentaries around the Iliad that are in the play, I think they try to raise those issues about what a battlefield looks like. It's not just bodies. All those bodies have specific names. There's a section of the play that talks about the various people we see dead on the battlefield, and it's not just a bunch of bodies. They're all individuals who had futures and hopes and dreams that are now gone. So there's, I think, by the virtue of the very nature of telling a pro-war piece, in some ways you are making an anti-war statement. And I think that also says something about an audience that sees this piece. I think a Berkeley audience sees something different from a La Jolla audience, which might see something different from a Montgomery, Alabama audience. You know, we just, depending on what the audience is you're playing to.
At the same time, there is a definite anti-war feel to
yeah.
it, without
yeah.
question.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think the overall message is there's a capriciousness and an infantile kind of quality that gets the war going. I mean, that opening section about Agamemnon and Achilles fighting over the prize, and the prize is a girl. I mean, it's like fifth grade. And you see these great men, these great warriors of their time being petulant and pouty, and I'm not going to play if it's not by my rules. And the upshot of that is death and destruction and for all the people around them, and by Achilles' inaction, he causes thousands of Greek soldiers to die because he won't fight. He's the great warrior, but he won't fight because they took his girl. You know, I mean, it's kind of silly on some level. But it is, yes, it does make that anti-war statement. You're right.
Henry Warrenitz, I know from talking to other actors that one of the great joys of working on a stage is you're playing off someone, and sometimes the words are less important than playing off on someone. Yeah. When you're doing a one-person show, that's completely different.
I thought it would be, yes, and I thought it would be much lonelier than it actually has turned out to be. But, and I think the reason for that is because this particular piece has so much direct address to the audience. There are some one-person shows that, even though the character is talking to the audience, there's still a sense that he's talking to one person. He's talking to a confidant of some sense, or he or she is talking to someone that they're personally connected to. The character of the poet in An Iliad spends a lot of time talking to individual people in the audience. I'm trying to find individual responses. And so I feel like I have, you know, 350 scene partners every night. So it doesn't feel as lonely as I thought it would be. And there's actually a great dynamic. Now, there's a humorous kind of double edge to that, because I look at the audience so much every night. 98% of the people are engaged. I can see it in their faces. They're paying attention. They're serious, or they're smiling, or they're laughing, whatever. But there's always a handful of people every night. Within the first 5 minutes, I will see someone with their head in their hand, kind of leaning on their sleep and just asleep. Just asleep and just kind of gone, or just really looking like they really don't want to be there. Because I get to look at them right in the face, and they've been brought there by their boyfriend or their girlfriend or their husband or wife or something, and they really didn't want to come, and they did have to sit through this one guy spouting about war on stage with this little smoke, and the lights are dark, and they just fall asleep.
Do you ever imagine that there's one person in the audience that you're speaking to?
It's easier to see the people in the first couple rows, and so I can connect with them. When I get back to like the fifth and sixth rows back in the dark, it's harder for me to connect with people individually. So I think of one person out there that I'm making sure I'm not ignoring that part of the stage. It can be an easy thing to fall into, of just being able to act to the people you can see when you're doing that kind of direct address. And there's a much greater arc of up and down in terms of what's close and what's far in the distance in this theater. So I do have to expend some effort and kind of conscious effort to make sure that I'm playing to all the audience. And sometimes that helps to think of one person up in the back there.
Henry Warrenitz, not long ago I interviewed Carrie Perloff of ACT, and we were talking about the new theater being put up for ACT.
Right, yes, I heard about that.
And the Geary, and she remarked that Berkeley Rep's Thrust Stage, she thinks, is the best stage to work on in the entire Bay Area. How do you feel about that?
Well, I've only worked on a couple of them. I've worked on the Geary some years ago, and I worked on the Thrust Stage 25 years ago. I was in a production of Playboy the Western World here. And those are the only two stages really in the Bay Area I've worked on. But I love Thrust Stages. I think the point is, generally, you can agree with that a Thrust Stage brings the action right out into the audience. The audience is around you. You get to really interact with them. Even if it's a fourth wall play where you're not really talking to the audience, they're right there, and you can feel them very present. I've always liked the analogy that working on a Thrust Stage is like working in sculpture, and working in a proscenium is like working in a painting. And I think sculpture is much more interesting because it's just more three-dimensional. I mean, if you want to look at it in that kind of qualification, the Thrust Stage here is a wonderful kind of asymmetrical tongue that sticks out into the audience, and the audience around you is somewhat asymmetrical, and it's I like that. I like the off balance of it. So it's been fun to work in. Again, my background is Shakespeare. The Globe Theatre in London was a Thrust Stage. I mean, it came right out into the courtyard, and most of the audience stood around on the ground around it. So it's a very old form of relationship between the performer and the audience, and I think it's a good one.
When you're working on a play like this, getting it going is pretty difficult because, A, you're memorizing, and B, mm-hmm. you're blocking, and it's
right.
only you, and
right.
C, there's the lighting, and the lighting needs to be perfect.
Yeah.
How difficult was it to assemble all that, this particular show?
It's a complicated show, and you can see because there are many, many, many lighting cues, and there's a sound score that Brian Ellingson, our bassist, plays, and he's, you know, We refer to this as a one-man show, but there really are two people in it. I mean, although Brian doesn't have any lines, but he's there as the muse, the spirit of energy and creativity that the poet relies on. There's a lot of complicated lights and timing and very specific places I need to be on stage for the lights to hit me in certain places, because it's very changeable that way. And so rehearsing in the rehearsal hall, you know, is fine, because you're working it out. And Lisa and I, we worked for about almost, I think, 2 weeks together, maybe a little over a week together, just ourselves and the stage management. And then Brian arrived to start to add the music in, which was a great addition for me, because suddenly I didn't feel as alone. And when you're doing a one-man show in a rehearsal hall and there's just you and the director and a stage manager and an assistant, you're not getting much back. I mean, after the first week or two, it's like playing to a void, and then suddenly you get an audience, and all this energy happens. But I remember there was a real trick going into the theater, because there's a lot of footlights, there are front lights, and suddenly I had been playing, expecting to play to the audience with a lot of energy and a lot of connection, and suddenly I couldn't see anything. I couldn't see the audience. I couldn't see the seats. And it took me a day to kind of adjust, and suddenly all my lines went out of my head, and I was like, oh my God, this is never going to work. But then, as we worked through, and Lisa's a wonderful director. She loves tech, and she was a great joy to work with, and she's done this with four other actors, this piece, and she could have easily come in and said, Henry, this is how it works, do it like this. But she really didn't. She allowed me to explore it in my own way, and she guided me in that way, and we added pieces of music responding to things that I was bringing to the piece. And that's, it was very, felt very, very collaborative with a piece that, again, she had done a lot. She had co-authored and she directed it, and so she could have just said, this is how it works, do it this way. So I was very grateful for that. But there is a huge technical element that gets, with any play this happens, but with this play particularly, it gets kind of, it gets, I don't want to say dumped on it, but suddenly it's there, and you have to deal with it and put it together. And there's a lot of, 6 inches to the right, 3 inches to the left, no, put the chair down here. And you hope that all comes together, but it is complicated. It is complicated.
You're listening to an interview with Henry Warenitz, who is the sole actor in An Iliad, which is playing at Berkeley Rep in Berkeley through November 18th. All right, you talked before about lines going out of your head. Yeah. What happens in all of those performances if suddenly it goes out of your head for a second? Has it?
For a second, yes. I mean, that happens almost in any production. For a second, you're not quite sure what the next thing might be. I mean, that's why we rehearse. And there's a kind of muscle memory and an almost kind of a mental, psychic memory of what the next line is. As you mentioned earlier, when you're in a play, a traditional play with other characters, you're in a situation, you're sitting in a room, there's a certain action, there's a certain narrative that's going on, so it's easier if you go up in your lines, you can improvise a little bit. I've had a couple moments here where I've gone up just for a second, because this character's language is so improvisational throughout the piece, it's easy to just stumble and then get to the next piece. But yeah, I do really know the story really well by this time. And Lisa was, very clear with this early on, saying, Henry, it's okay. If you forget a little something, just keep going, because you know what the story is. You know what the next part of it is. And so I've been very pleased, knock on wood here, that I haven't had any moments where I've just kind of gone totally up. One of the big memorization pieces in the piece that's really pure memorization is that 144 list of wars, right? There are moments night to night when I'm never sure what the next thing is, but it just comes out. I mean, it's like one long word. I just get my brain out of the way and just let my mouth keep going. And that's proved to be a really kind of existential moment going through those lists. But I haven't had any bad kind of moments where feeling, oh, my God, I don't know where I am. What am I going to do?
It's also a very, very physical piece. You're doing a lot. Did you do a lot of did you go to the gym a lot beforehand?
I've always been a very physical actor. I like movement. I like moving on stage. As a young actor in college, I did some mime. I've done a lot of Shakespeare, which always involves some kind of stage combat. I've, played Richard III and Henry V and Macbeth and all these roles that kind of require you to do a certain kind of physicality. I've played Cyrano de Bergerac and Peer Gynt, and there's a lot of, I enjoy physicality in the acting. And this character just kind of, it's not something you necessarily plan, but there's an energy to this kind of one-man storytelling. He's like a one-man orchestra, so he's trying to keep everything going, and I work up quite a sweat.
Sometimes.
I think sometimes I may be working a little harder than I need to. What you learn in the run of a play is particularly a play like this that has such a vocal demand. Your voice can get worn out, your body can get worn out, and there are places that you realize as you start to really get comfortable with the piece, and this happened in La Jolla, that, oh, I don't need to work that hard there. I can rely on the languages, tell the story, and find a better balance and not burn myself out halfway through as opposed to, you know, getting all the way through and to the end of the piece. So that's been, it's always, you know, that kind of acting, doing a piece like this, which is very demanding, is always very instructive for an actor, for someone who's in the midst of it, of learning from the process.
Henry Warrenitz, when I interviewed Stephen Sondheim, he talked about taking notes during the run of a show because he said actors tend to get logy and get a little bit slow. Is that something you found?
I think every actor wants to fight with that. You can get indulgent, particularly in moments that you think are great and emotional moments. Again, this comes from my Shakespeare training. Shakespeare has a certain forward motion and rhythm to it, so I've always been a big proponent of keeping the language moving. And Lisa, actually, in rehearsals in La Jolla, would frequently tell me, slow down, slow down, slow down, slow down. Then finally, we got up here, we got to remount this and that. She goes, okay, Henry, you can speed up now. You can go faster now. And we kind of tighten some things. And there's kind of a roughly an ideal time between 1 hour 37, 1 hour 40, right in that ballpark is kind of where we want to be. And that just comes from Lisa and I doing the show, and she's saying, yeah, that feels about the right timing of it. So after every performance, I'm always checking with the stage manager, how was our time tonight? And I'm usually pretty good as an actor of feeling the pace of a play, but I think it's just particular to a one-person piece. I find it much harder to judge how the pace of the evening is going when it's just me. Just me in the middle of it. It's hard. It's really hard to tell. But Kimberly Webb, our stage manager, is a good stopwatch keeper, so he keeps me on track with that.
Do you think having worked so many years as a director helps you on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly something that I talk about a lot as a director. And as I said, I was teaching acting recently over the past number of years. And one of the things I would tell my young actors when we got into runs of things, I could say, you know, if you find yourself enjoying a pause, you can rest assured that I am not.
Henry Warrenitz, let's go back a little bit and talk a little bit about your career. Mm-hmm. You were a theater major in college?
I was. I have an undergraduate degree of a communication arts and science major, which was a fancy word for speech and theater at the time. But, I graduated from Bridgewater State College, a little state college in Massachusetts, in 1976.
Did you go to New York afterward?
I was never interested in New York. I've never lived in New York. I spent a little time in New York in 2005. I was in my one and only Broadway production. It was a production of Julius Caesar that Denzel Washington was starring in. He was playing Brutus. And I had, you know, four or five little minor roles, which was great fun. But that's the only time I've ever really worked in New York. I became a regional theater actor pretty quickly. I was in some children's theater in Boston, New England, where I grew up. And then I worked at a small Shakespeare repertory company in Boston that's long since gone, the Boston Shakespeare Company. And that was kind of my graduate school. I never did graduate school. I spent 6 years there doing repertory of five or six Shakespeare plays a year. And at that time, I was in 30-something Shakespeare plays and playing some roles well before I ever had the right to play them. And then I spent a summer at the Utah Shakespeare Festival in 1984, and then I went to the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in 1985. And I've worked in various other regional theaters around, but I was never all that interested in New York. I'm not a big city person. I like cities to spend some time in, but I've lived enough in kind of more rural and suburban settings that I kind of enjoy that energy more than a city.
Well, you spent several years in Ashland.
I'd spent almost 12 years in Ashland, not straight through, but on and off over about 12 years.
And you did some work in Hollywood as well. How was it working? First of all, how did you wind up doing television? And a couple of quick questions. What was it like working on Seinfeld, and what was it like working on Star Trek Voyager?
Well, I got to Hollywood because I was in Ashland for most of the late 80s, early 90s, and there are frequent casting people that come up from L.A. and to come to Ashland. And you'd have an off-season time, and you'd go down and maybe spend some time in Los Angeles for a couple months trying to find some just connections about looking. You're always looking for work. Actors are always looking for work. My last 5 years at Oregon Shakespeare, I was the artistic director, and then it was time for me to move on. I wanted to do some other things, and I really wanted to give Hollywood a shot and just to see if I could get some film and television work. My partner at the time, she was a director as well, and she was working at Ashland. And she was at Ashland an additional season after I left, and then we came down. We were in L.A. together. And I, you know, was looking for television acting work, and I was, you know, in my early 40s, and it was kind of an odd time to be there. And, you know, I had agents tell me, you have a wonderful resume, this and that, but, you know, why should we bother with you? We got Michael Douglas, you know. If you were 18 and looked like Brad Pitt, we could talk or something, but... I had an agent, and I got some decent little work, and I did a couple dozen television shows in the 3 years I was there. And the Seinfeld, you were asking about Seinfeld and Voyager. I felt kind of blessed by the projects I did end up on, because a successful L.A. television show or film is usually one that's been very well thought through, produced well. The people manage it well. They know what they're doing. The Seinfeld was a joy to do. I had I did two episodes, one season, then the next season. I played the same character, a priest named Father Curtis. It's a very famous episode called the Yada 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 about Jerry's dentist converting to Judaism so he could tell Jewish jokes. The Star Treks are fun, and the Star Trek casting folks loved Shakespearean actors because there's all that technical gobbledygook language that they have to use in Star Trek, and so they liked people that could handle language. So, I mean, you'd work on a Star Trek show, and there'd be all these Shakespeare actors around all over the place, Patrick Stewart, you know, being the prime example. So, I mean, they were fun projects to work, and I did two Voyagers, and I did one Next Generation at one point. So.
What was it like working with Patrick Stewart?
A delight. I had met Patrick at some L.A. after party somewhere before, and I think he was just starting the Star Trek thing. But I had known him, his work as an RSC actor from England, and I had just recently played Titus Andronicus, which is a role I know that he had played. So I came up to him and I said, you know, we have something in common, Titus Andronicus. And we got talking about being a Shakespearean actor or a classical actor in Hollywood. And he said to me, you know, I have a 17-year gap on my resume that I don't talk about, the 17 years he was with the Royal Shakespeare Company.
And doing Seinfeld meant you were dealing with amazing comedians.
Oh, yes, yeah, and it was fun to watch them. I particularly remember Michael Richards, who played Kramer, who was a very physical actor, was always had those bits of coming in the door and this and that, and he was always off to the side going through his physicalities, going through his moments, going through his little, so he could get the routine down, get comfortable, and then kind of wing it. So he didn't have to make it up right on the spot when they were filming. So he was spending a lot of time off to the side doing that. And Jason Alexander's a wonderful actor, and Julia Louis-Dreyfus was fun to work with. I had the second episode I did, I had a number of scenes with her, which was great. And Jerry, you know, Jerry is just Jerry. I mean, he's, you know, I've talked to these guys like I know them. And I spent, you know, all of, you know, maybe 20 hours with them. But, you know, it's the curse of being a popular television show. Everybody thinks they know you because you look so familiar to them. But Jerry was just, you know, what you saw on camera was kind of what you saw offstage. He was just that kind of very natural, kind of easygoing fella who wasn't really an actor, but he was a performer, and he had a great charm to him. And so it was kind of fun. It was fun to work on.
Do you miss any of that now?
You miss the paychecks. The paydays in Los Angeles are very healthy, generally. If you're working consistently, you can make a decent living there doing that as an actor. So, I mean, you can see why it's such a magnet to people. I think when I got to L.A., I was late in my career, and I think there were some things I needed to learn about how to work on camera and this and that, and I've subsequently done much more work on camera, and I've taught a little bit, and so I think I would be better at it now. My partner and I were thinking seriously of moving to the Bay Area, I think, in the next year or two when she retires, and I think we're interested in the theatrical community here and the arts community here, but there's more opportunities for doing other things, teaching and film and television and things like that as well. So,
when you look at teaching acting, do you take any particular stance toward the method or neighborhood playhouse or anything like that?
No, I'm not that doctrinaire about it. Although there are some basic things that I think through my own training and my own background that have become paramount to my teaching acting, which has to do with language, and that it kind of boils down into why are you saying these words now? A playwright is a very deliberate creature. They spend massive amounts of time trying to put their script together and to put the right words in the character's mouth, you know, a good one. And the great ones, you know, Tennessee Williams, Arthur Miller, Tony Kushner, you know, all the great playwrights really do that well. And the actor's job is to figure out why they're saying these things. And that goes into the foundation of modern acting, of course, is the Stanislavski system of what Americans call the method. But it goes beyond that. But it is really about the kind of the heart-mind connection. And for me, because of my Shakespeare background, I've always been interested in how the heart-mind manifests through language. And I'm very interested in language. And when I teach acting, I spend a lot of the focus of our work is about what you're saying. And why do you use that word now? And so that becomes kind of a detective process, I think, for an actor, for a young actor working on a script. You take it apart like you would any kind of textual analysis and figuring out why you're saying those things. And that leads to the deeper underlying motivations and reasons and articulations of the psyche, of the desires, the wants that a human being wants or that particularly human being needs to make sure that their story gets told.
Well, the problem, of course, with Shakespeare, for those of us in the audience, is that the language is archaic and it's very hard to follow, which means that the best Shakespeare has to somehow reach across the centuries.
Yeah. You're absolutely right, and it needs very good actors. It needs actors to know how to handle it, because I would argue that it's not so much the language that's archaic, but it's the thought processes behind. You know, to be or not to be, that is the question. There's not a word there we don't understand, but what's the thoughts and the psyche behind that, underneath it, what's going on with that process, I think can feel somewhat removed to our very kind of often feels like a black and white thinking process of modern life. When Shakespeare's characters go off into their long soliloquies trying to figure out what they're going to do or why they're going to do it, when I would teach Shakespeare, we would talk a lot about there's a real particular logic to his writing. To be or not to be, that is the question, kind of starts with a thesis statement. That's what I'm going to talk about. And then he'll spend the rest of that piece working through that to come to some kind of conclusion. And Shakespeare, as a young boy in his schooling in Stratford, was trained to, you know, kind of argue through an idea in language, and they did it in Latin, and the old story about they had to learn to thank you, sir, for your letter in 197 different ways, you know, things like that. So, but there's a logic to it, I think, that maybe is more archaic than the language necessarily. But you're right. Yeah, I mean, and all the great teachers of Shakespeare, it all comes down to, you know, getting the actors to understand what they're saying, how to communicate that, and making sure that the audience follows them.
Is it a mistake to teach Shakespeare without seeing Shakespeare?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Shakespeare's meant to be seen. I mean, probably one of the best ways to explain that is that Shakespeare himself took very little interest in getting his plays printed or produced in that way. And I think it was a very live art, the theater in Elizabethan times, as it is now and as it should be now. But Shakespeare in particular, I think, is meant to be seen. It's meant to be heard and experienced live in front of you. So absolutely.
And how about Shakespearean films?
You know, Shakespeare actually lends itself very well to film because his stories are always very dynamic. There's always some kind of love thing in the middle of it that's trying to find some kind of fruition, trying to work its way out. Shakespeare film, the thing that it does sacrifice is the text, because you do have to cut lots of the text, because film is a visual medium and Shakespeare is an oral medium. You know, we're listening to it. The old story is that the Elizabethans used to say, let's go hear a play. And they were players. They weren't actors. They were players. Ian McKellen often points out that we talk about the folks that go to the theater as an audience, you know, with the root of the word audio, and that people who watch movies or televisions are viewers, you know, so that I think there's some truth in that. But I think absolutely Shakespeare's best taught by watching it.
Henry Warrenitz, you're playing through November 18th. Are you going to be taking this elsewhere?
No, this is the last stop. It was a co-production with the Hoya Playhouse and Berkeley Reps, and this will be it.
Anything worked up from here?
I've got a little time off, and then in March I'm going to be playing the role of Bottom in A Midsummer Night's Dream at the Indiana Repertory Theater in Indianapolis, which I think opens in early April sometime.
You've been listening to an interview with Henry Warrenitz, who is the star of An Iliad, now playing at Berkeley Rep in Berkeley through November 18th. For more information, you can go to berkeleyrep.org. I'm Richard Walensky on Open Book.